Greetings, everyone. This is Koku from the Bitter Medicine Podcast, inviting you to tune in to the Bitter Medicine Podcast on KWAZ Radio.
Peace, family. This is Oni, inviting you to listen to the pro-black perspective, where black problems are addressed with black solutions.
All right, welcome to the fifth episode of our interview segment of the Harsh Reality Podcast. And in this segment, we look to bring on professionals, influencers, scholars, and any knowledgeable or interesting individuals to tell their own story and also to hear their unique takes on the news of the day. And I personally think it's more beneficial and insightful for the listener to hear a person's perspective rather than a traditional question and answer format. So that's how we're going to work it today. And firstly, I have to shout out Melanated Conscious Society. MCS, headquartered in Jacksonville, Florida, is a mentorship organization teaching various life skills, self-sufficiency, and knowledge of self to the youth. Follow them on Facebook and Instagram for latest news, meetings, and valuable information. Also think they're going to a virtual platform right now with everything going on. So make sure y'all hit Caprael up and see about the virtual classes they're doing right now. Also, shout out to the KWAZ Radio family. KWAZ providing the latest and greatest in conscientious-oriented content. Follow them on all forms of social media as well. Subscribe to the Bitter Medicine Podcast hosted by Koku and the Pro Black Perspectives hosted by the Brother Oni. That's one of my good followers on Twitter, man. That dude's always dropping something. And lastly, the podcast is now on Patreon. Please donate. And of course, all proceeds go to upgrading the show and providing the best content we can for loyal listeners. Also, for those looking to be featured in our business spotlight or just looking out to reach out to the show to drop an email or any kind of criticism or you know, drop any kind of ideas for a show, y'all can email us at theharshrealitypod@gmail.com. And now, without further ado, let me get to my esteemed co-host who's been chilling in the background while I go through my spiel here. And our guest today is the outspoken, knowledgeable, and powerful Koku, host of the Bitter Medicine Podcast and a staunch Pan-Africanist. His unwavering brand of truth spreading was one of the inspirations for starting my own platform here. And I'm grateful and highly honored that the brother has taken my invitation to come on the pod and discuss a few topics with me today. Koku, what's up, brother?
Hey, what's going on, D-Web? thanks for having me. Thanks for that cool introduction. I appreciate it.
No problem, man. Definitely got to give you flowers while you're here, man. Like I said, you're a great inspiration to me. And one of the reasons I decided I can, you know, come on here and try to, you know, spread my little two cents of knowledge out here to the world. So I appreciate you for that.
Yeah. You know, I just gotta say this, man. The work that you guys have been doing on this show is good stuff, man, because it's topical, it's current, it's funny, you know, it's engaging, and you know, it's something I hope a lot of people are taking in. You know what I mean? It's good work on you guys' part.
Appreciate it. Yeah, that got the brother LL is always dropping the a quotable, man. That's like my comic relief there. That dude be killing me. But tell us a little bit. I wanted to start with a little introduction, you know, for those who may not know. Of course, you're part of KWAZ Radio family along with us and the pro-black perspective with Oni over there. And also the Queen's Council, man. I forgot to shout them out. Shout out to the Queen's Council dropping those bombs over there with Cherise, man. We miss over here. But
yes.
Tell us about yourself and anything you know would think would be beneficial to the listener of this podcast here if they haven't heard of you before.
So, you know, I started the Bitter Medicine Podcast. Well, the idea occurred around, I want to say it was 2014. Whenever it was that we started losing a lot of young black youth, like Mike Brown, Trayvon Martin, you know, et cetera. And I just got tired of, you know, our people not discussing our issues the way we really ought to be discussing them if we're serious about creating a change. I look at people marching and protesting, and all that is walking in a circle, right? That's not really getting at the heart of the matter to really affect some change. And so I wanted to, you know, when I started to conceive the show, I wanted a show, initially I wanted a show that spoke that harsh truth, you know, that bitter medicine that was healing for our people. But also if some European or something stumble upon the show, you could hear some truth about yourself as well, right? About your pathology. And so that's how the Bitter Medicine Podcast started. But me personally, even before that, you know, I'm from the Bahamas. I grew up in a family that was very political. You know, my uncle was a professor in the United States. He tried to create a third political party back home that was built on a socialist ideology. And so I was always around it. And I think the thing I have to thank folks like my uncle for is that even as a kid, say 10 years old, he would sit me and his son down to listen to his speeches and stuff. And then he will actually grill us about the speech. And I'll be honest with you, I hated it. But at the same time, because it immersed me, as I grew older and certain concepts started to come to bear in front of me, I was able to connect it back to a lot of the things he was talking about. Now, I'm not a socialist presently, but I do understand generally where the socialists are coming from. So that's, you know, that's the basis of my ideology. I'm an African spiritualist. I don't believe, you know, I shunned that whole white God stuff a long time ago. The whole Christianity stuff, as you know, and
war with God,
war on God, exactly.
Yeah, that was a great episode, man.
I appreciate it. Yeah, you were very vocal about that episode, and I appreciate that. You know, so yeah, so that's me in a nutshell. I'm just this, you know, a black guy who, and I, you know, an African. I'm not afraid to you know, embrace that. I'm an African by way of the Caribbean. And so, you know, I believe that, you know, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later, but I just believe that we need to be coming together, number one, and number two, we have to come together on an agenda. And that agenda is to find solutions to our collective problems.
Word. That was very in-depth, man. And I enjoyed hearing it and definitely breaking down some of your ideology and some of where you're coming from and your beliefs, man. And like I said, when I discovered you, you know, one of the first things I heard was, you know, the War on God episode, you know, and also, you know, just searching for any kind of black media in general was just such a hard thing, you know. And that was a few years ago. You have a lot of platforms popping up now, particularly with, you know, a lot of people out of work and a lot of people not able to go to work and with the pandemic and everything. So you have a lot more platforms popping up currently. But when I first started searching, man, it was like maybe a handful, you know, that I could really find through the, you know, searching through the Googles and the pod apps of the world and things like that. And it was just very refreshing to hear something, you know, not only were you willing to tell the truth, but you were very vocal, very strong about it. It wasn't, you didn't, lack of a better term, you didn't pussyfoot around when you talked about these things, right? So that was kind of one of the things that drew me to, you know, your platform. So,
yeah, and you know, I appreciate that you mentioned that, because at the time when I came into the space, you know, you had the few black voices you had, a lot of them were unserious, in my humble opinion. You know, you had some of these guys, they talked down to the listeners. You know, you had some of these guys always trying to clown around and all this kind of stuff. But this is serious business, man. This is not like if you go, you were in the military. If you go to a military meeting, dudes ain't clowning around. People, you know, minds are serious, right? And so this is the kind of stuff we got to deal with. We got to deal with stuff seriously. There's a time and there's a place and a space for the unserious type of stuff. So I want to be serious. I mean, people don't know this, but in my real life, I'm very humorous, but you won't tell that from my show, because I just take the conversation so seriously, you know?
Yeah, if you're talking on serious issues, particularly if you look at the standing of you know, the African or the black person throughout the diaspora, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, if you look at the what's going on, how we from a such a resource-rich continent and at the bottom of every wealth category. Like, it makes no sense. And I think a lot of people just live to be entertained, man. I made that point a long time ago that way too many people are just looking to be entertained on a daily basis rather than looking and seeking knowledge, solutions, things like that.
Yeah. If you look at my YouTube channel, you'll see that one of the most popular videos I've done is a recent video where I was discussing this incident that happened on this podcast that I used to like a lot called the 5150 Show, right? And because it's like a beef type thing, you know, it's entertainment. You know, those numbers were crazy. I couldn't believe the amount of comments I was getting and all that stuff. But it just goes to show. Meanwhile, I have interviews with guys like Maj Toure. I have interviews with Obadeli Cambone. I have masterclass, episodes on business, like the guy from Symphony Chips and all that kind of stuff that, you know, have decent numbers, but nothing like, you know, this particular video. It just shows that we're more so about the gratification of entertainment than really trying to find the solutions to our problems.
Exactly. If you look at like the Versus thing, right? Every time they have one of these Versus, man, it's just the numbers. It's just you see it posted everywhere. There's comments and everything. But then, you know, if you point somebody to something, a speech, or you point somebody to a book or something that's serious, you do nothing. I've seen this recently that if I make like a post, you know, being like serious, hey, you know, check out this book, you know, Destruction of Black Civilization, blase, blase. And it's like, no likes, no, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But if I say something crazy, you know what I mean? I say something entertainment wise, talk about the Versus or talk about a basketball game or something. It's like numbers off the chain. So it's like, come on, man. And it's all right to be entertained, right? Yeah. Life is not always serious, man. You'd go crazy if you were, you know, serious 100% of the time. But at the same time, you have to employ a balance. It's about my yacht. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You got to have that balance.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So let me get into the topics here. The first thing I got is we just had recently Joe Biden was talking about more executive orders. A lot of people look at it as an attack on the Second Amendment. And it's funny you just spoke about having an interview with Maj Toure. I already know what he would say about it. But should Black Americans particularly be weary of any attempts to limit firearm ownership? You know, what are your thoughts on these executive orders? And
oh, yeah. First of all, absolutely. Because the Second Amendment has always been a tool of white supremacy. And you see, here's the thing. The big problem that we have in Black society is that we don't understand. It's not about policy. It's about pathology, right? It's not about white policies. It's about their white pathology. And so once you understand that you're dealing with, and I hope this doesn't, you know, rub anyone wrong on your platform, but once you understand that you're dealing with a savage being, right? And I'm not talking some Nick Cannon type shit. I'm talking real, right? I'm talking real. Look at the history, right? Look at the paperwork, right? We're talking about some true savages here. Once they're in control of something, expect savagery, right? And so one of the reasons why the Second Amendment has always been this tool of this white pathology, this white so-called white supremacy, is that, let's be honest, what they have done to non-whites in history, they better find ways to limit our access to, you know, WMDs, right?
Right.
Because, and you know, that's one of their biggest fears, by the way. They know what they've done. And they know that if given a chance, what could quite literally happen in return. And so they enact all these little amendments and laws to kind of hold you back from being able to really, number one, be an aggressor towards them, and number two, to protect yourself from their aggression. Right?
Exactly. And you hit on something too, gun control rights. If you look back in the day at who was not allowed to carry, you know, guns, who was it? The slaves, right?
Right.
The slaves, colored people, period. As they called them back then. I hate to use that terminology, but that's the term they use. Yeah. You were not allowed to carry weapons, right? Mm-hmm. So when you and then if you break down the pathology that you were talking about, the so-called founding fathers were the terrorists of their day, right?
Yes, absolutely.
If you want to go back to savagery, that's why they made these, you know, laws and things, because they know that, you know, that if you allow only one entity, that being the government, to only have the weapons in your country, guess what? You're now a slave.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Period.
Mm-hmm.
And people need to look at that. You got, and then I hear all these takes, man. The takes are terrible that I hear from people. They talk about hunting. They talk about protecting your house. They talk about all this self-defense. In reality, none of that has anything to do with that amendment. You know, that whole amendment, that whole thing was revolved around, if your government is fucking with you,
yep,
you have the right to fight back. You have the means, right? Yep. And then it's just such a cognitive dissonance, because a lot of the more so left-leaning black people I meet who are more, you know, adept or more, you know, along the lines of agreeing that, you know, gun control should be limited, gun rights should be limited and things like that. A few months ago, you were saying how you had the biggest fascists in the world as a president.
Right.
So what if another one pops up, right? What are you supposed to do then?
Right.
So you can't fight that battle, right?
And you know, so to, again, you got to go back to the beginning to understand something, you know, currently, right? Or something future, right? Like, that was the basis of the Second Amendment, right? And then if you look at its history, in fact, you just mentioned the orange one a second ago. In 2019, the orange one and some of his shills were pushing for, I think the guy, what's that guy's name in Georgia? Doug Collins, I think is his name. Yeah, Doug Collins. They would sneak in those gun law bills, like those bills that are like, you know, trying to close the gun loopholes and making sure that there's like these background checks from person to person sales and all that stuff. To get the law passed, which is just a sensible law, right? But to get passed, they threw in this anti-immigration provision. You see? And who's the immigrants that they're talking about, right? It's black and brown people. You know what I'm saying? So it always has this history of being racist, and it still carries on that history today.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree with that, but I mean, the man said so. Where's the shithole countries at? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, who are you referring to when you use that terminology, right?
As if Eastern Europe is a popping spot. Like, come on.
Yeah, like they having you know, parades and sunny, and the sun's always shining in Bosnia over there, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, and so I think we broke that down pretty good, man. So let me move on to this next one. I think this will resonate pretty well with you, being that you're, you know, an educator.
Yes.
And we had this the recent pandemic, which kind of presented a great opportunity, I think, for our people to switch up the education system, particularly with the public school system, as I know Oni likes to say. And my question is, why haven't more people, you know, seized on this advantage or this opportunity to open up their own education centers, right? We've already preached that, you know, the worst thing you probably could do is have your so-called oppressor, your so-called enemy teach your kids, right? So why haven't people more seized these opportunities? I know they have these different pods they have. I know we had the brother King Randall open up his own school down there. And I think he recently went on Roland Martin, and kind of got chastised over there, but and that's a whole different topic going on that guy. But
actually, Roland is actually a part of the answer here. The thing with, so in that interview, Roland also kind of insinuated why should we as black folks have to create our own education, you know, centers and our own opportunities, right? Because Roland Martin represents one of the, you talk about white pathology, there's also black pathology too. And Roland Martin represents the black pathology. I think Franz Fanon referred to it as, what did he call it again? The neuro, something. I can't remember now. But the psycho existential complex, that's what he called it, right? Mm-hmm. And we have that too. They have it. And because they have it, we have some counter form of it. The point I'm getting at is, when you think about the history, say in America, where a white guy had to, you know, a white guy came along and said, okay, you guys are free now, right? Slavery has been abolished. I've abolished it, right? For whatever the reasons that he did it. But when you look at that, and then you go from that and you say, well, the government should be doing the stuff for us. The same way this white guy came along, this government official came along and abolished slavery, then some white guy should come along or some government official should come along and fix our schools and fix the roads around us and do this and do that. And I think folks in general, particularly in America, and this is not putting down Black Americans or nothing like that, because Black Caribbeans, you know, Africans, we're all under the same system here in America once we're here.
Yeah.
But the idea is that we tend to look for the government or some other person to do it. And the reality is, if you're going to fix your problems, you have to be the problem solver. You see? And that's where we've gone wrong. We are not, number one, we are not educated to solve our problems. If you look at the public school system, shout out to Oni Tase, if you look at the public school system doesn't prepare you to solve the problems around you. You know, like for example, like conflict resolution. Did you learn that in school?
Hell no, not at
all. No. So what's the big problem we have in Black communities? A lot of intra-racial violence and stuff like that, because we don't know how to really sit down and talk and, you know, work things out and stuff like that. So the public school system doesn't teach you how to solve your own problems. So a lot of Black people by default fall back on that, and especially in education. Listen, there's a sister named Dr. Barbara Sizemore from, I think she's from your area, from Chicago, right?
Right.
And she was brilliant, is brilliant. I think she's still alive, but she's older now. She's brilliant. And she talked about the need for kind of like African-centered education. But even in her talking about that, even with her, I realized that she's also always talking about the government making that change and making things African-centered and appealing to the African mind, like Dr. Amos Wilson would say. But again, that's wrong too, in my humble opinion. We have to take it upon ourselves to do it, but we have to learn how to do that, you know?
Word. I agree with everything you just said too. Self-sufficiency itself is not looked upon greatly in this land, as we all know. And everybody's looking for a solution, as somebody to solve their problems for them. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. One of the things you talked about was conflict resolution right there, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at traditionally what has been a tenet of masculinity, it's supposed to be logical thinking.
Yes.
You're supposed to be a logical thinker as a man. You're supposed to be a strategist. You're supposed to learn, you know, these different strategies and tactics to overcome your problems and overcome your solutions. You're supposed to be a problem solver that's a tenet of masculinity. And it seems like when we went away from education system that was more so segregated to gender wise, to be honest with you, used to have boys' schools and girls' schools, right?
Yes.
And there wasn't nothing inherently bad about that. We all agree that it is a difference between the genders. That doesn't mean one is superior or inferior to the other. In fact, they're complementary to each other. Mm-hmm. And when you had these male-only institutions where you had a lot of male teachers who were there to educate these kids, not only in the system of education, but all in knowledge and obtaining, you know, history and arts and arithmetic, but they also taught them about masculinity. You know, how to be a man, how to solve problems, how to take care of your family, what you need to do, what makes you an upstanding male. And I think once you got rid of that, then you have what you have now. The large majority of educators nowadays, look, are female.
Yes. Yes.
And it takes a man to teach a man how to be a man. You know what I mean? So
yes. Shout out to you, single mothers who wish each other happy Father's Day. for Father's Day, That kind of stuff is just ridiculous to me. The reality of it is you can raise a male, you can't raise a man as a woman, right?
Right.
You can raise a male, you cannot raise a man. You look at guys like Kanye West. The reason why Kanye West is the way he was raised by women.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why you see a lot of these conflicts out in the streets in Chicago or here where I am in New York and stuff like that is if you stand at a distance and you look at the actions of these males, and I say males intentionally, you look at the actions of these males, it's the same action that you have with your girlfriend nagging you or arguing with you or trying to fight you or something. It's the same exact actions. These guys are watching their moms and how they deal with conflict, right? And I'm not trying to put it all on women because it's on us too, right? It's on males too. But that's the big problem that we're having. And so obviously and clearly the system makes it so that there's more women in the schools teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so that's a part of the strategy. We have to counter that with our own schooling, like, alluded to in your question. We have to challenge that by coming up with our own schooling. But here's the problem. And this is just the truth of the matter. The problem is educating has never been monetarily fruitful, which is a shame, because if you look at a guy like, let's take Jeff Bezos or whoever, right? These guys had to be educated. They had to have a teacher. And they are teachers who never made any kind of money close to what these guys have in the world, right? You know, educating is not fruitful. And because of it, and because of the situation that, you know, most Black communities suffer, where are we going to get the funding from? You know, how am I going to eat, you know, while trying to teach these children in the right way? And that's the thing we have to deal with. And we have to deal with that by making education kind of like a family thing, like a culture thing,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Basically public education of the public school system is basically extended babysitting. That's what it has boiled down to. They watch your kids while you work in so many hours a day. Right. And this system is by design so they can, you know, put whatever ideology that they want to, you know, employ on your kids to make them obedient, to make them, you know, better factory workers or better whatever. And that's part of it. But the thing we spoke to, the school system not being, or education itself not being lucrative, it is very lucrative. You know what I'm saying? The problem is that money is tied in with the state. We've seen a lot of school choice laws being passed across the country. Some of them even, I think Kentucky just recently passed one, where basically a lot of states, they're getting $20,000 a year just for your kid sitting in that seat. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's coming from taxpayer dollars, come from state budgets. I didn't even realize this because I was like a juvenile delinquent once I got to high school. I was smart, but, you know, I seen school as kind of a waste of time. And I was, you know, more interested in being in the streets and gambling, you know, doing whatever the hell I do in the streets.
Right.
And so, you know, what happened was I would be late every day. Right. And if you're late a certain amount of times during the year, what they do is they take you out of your first period class. And you basically sit in like a detention area for that first period, and then you go to your second period. And I never could figure that out. Be like, if I'm late to third period, they all don't drop me from that third period. But this first period is so imperative. And I did some research, you know, as a curious mind as to what was going on. The thing is, if you're not in that school building at this certain time, they don't get the full amount of money for you being there.
Mm.
So when they realize you're a chronic truant, in order to get that full money, they move you to second period, like you have a late start, and they get that money.
Right.
So once you figure that out, it's like, it's not about the kid. Because if in reality, you would find out why I'm late every day, why I'm not here, why this. But no, they don't do that. What they do is they just drop you. Okay. It's like employed as late every day, but you can't fire them. Okay. You just come at, you know, 2:30 instead of 1:30.
So you made a good point there that I should go back and clean up something I said. So in the educational system, you're absolutely correct. There is money there. Because the way these white folks work is that they create these platforms really to transfer wealth about the place, right? If you start a nonprofit organization, people will say, well, it's nonprofit. Well, the reality of it is people do profit, right? They write grants, they make their money, they pay some people this, that, and the other, but largely they make money too, right? So you're right. It is lucrative in that sense. I'm also was looking at the community teacher, not so much even the official certified educator, but the community teacher who wants to open up like a homeschooling type situation.
Mm-hmm.
That person, unfortunately, most people will look at that and say there's not a lot of demand for it. And so there's not a lot of money for it. There is demand, but it's not on the same level as, say, the public school system. And so a lot of people will kind of shy away from it. This is one of the reasons why I like Dr. Umar Johnson at one time, because unlike some of the other loudmouths out there, he actually was trying to create a school, right?
Maybe
right? Perhaps.
Yeah, continue though, I'm sorry.
You know, likely, kind of, you know. But he talked the right game. He talked about an education that actually speaks to our children, speaks to their culture, their tradition, and their abilities to solve problems. But even he found, I mean, he got like, I think it was like $750,000 or something like that. But I think he found out soon enough how expensive it is just to purchase a campus, how expensive it is to hire people, you know, and all that type of stuff, right? So I think that's the thing that kind of throws people off. And lastly, I think a lot of people just don't want to put in the work, man. You know, these things require effort.
Word.
And a lot of people just don't want, it's just easier to send your kid to the school. And you know, as you've heard me say before, I don't want to knock people who send their kids to the public school system because maybe, you know, for whatever reasons you have to. But the thing is, and this is the real key, in your home, there should be a culture of learning, a culture of problem solving.
I just got in on it.
And it should be African-centered, right? You need African solutions for African problems. And by African, I mean Black, and all that in between, right?
Right.
So that's my answer to that.
Yeah, that's what I would say. That would be like my like last point to that. Like, all right, if you have to, we know a lot of people aren't financially or savvy, or they're not, you know, like I said, it's very convenient to just send your kid. They got the bus route set up for you. Yeah. They got everything set up. All you got to do is register your kid and they go on. Away they go.
Yeah.
And if you're working in multiple jobs, you have multiple kids, if you're a single parent or whatever, this is like a godsend almost to you, because, you know, this is the way you can provide. But if you're going to go that route, the public school system should be the bare minimum, right?
Mm-hmm.
It should be like, you know, if you're starving, this is like a can of beans. You know, this should be the bare minimum. You should be supplementing that, right? If all you're getting is a can of beans from the state, you need to supplement that. You need to find you some chicken on the side. You need to find you some fruit, some vegetables to supplement that. And it should be just the bare minimum of what you're doing. You, on the weekends, what are you doing on the weekends? Those days off, what are you doing? Are you taking your kids somewhere where they can learn? Are you taking them to a museum so they can learn? Are you busting down books and reading with them? And honestly, man, a lot of kids are craving that attention, man. They act like they don't, you know, like it at the time because you're shoving tablets and television in front of your kids, stuff like that. But they will appreciate that time you take. Like you talked about your, what was it, your uncle?
Yeah.
Yeah, and later on in life, you appreciated those talks. You may have hated it at the time, you know, but looking back on it, that was valuable to you.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to
absolutely. You know, I, if I may, I just like to throw out there, you know, the Bitter Medicine podcast. One of the things, you know, it became apparent to me after a while that the podcast was an opportunity to educate. And with that idea, it came to me that, you know, maybe we should start working on African-centered curriculum. So that became a project of the podcast. That's just like the big project that I have, which is to work on African-centered education and to make it a community-based idea. Like, we have this Discord server, and, you know, we had some folks who participated in critiquing a previous African-centered curriculum. And the curriculum was nice. I don't know if you saw that, but the curriculum was nice, but it was vague. And I think the vagueness of it is because one person put it together, whereas we need the real community to come together and put this together. Like we need more voices from the community. So, you know, I invite people to join that endeavor as well. And the last thing I'll say is, the reason why it's so important to have African-centered curriculum, you know, African-centered education centers, et cetera, for our people, for our children. And by the way, D-Web, I appreciate you even asking this question, right? The reason why it's so important is because, take Flint, Michigan, for example. Flint, Michigan hasn't had clean water for about 6 years now, I think, right? Mm-hmm. And why is that? Because you're waiting for the government or whomever to come in there and fix your problem. When the reality is, the government is just going to keep that going, get a bunch of y'all to move out the area, and they're going to have their people come in and gentrify the spot, right?
Right.
But if you had an education system where, and I'm not talking about in place just today, I'm talking about if you had an education system in place, let's say, 30 years ago, that taught Black kids to be proud of their Blackness and to be exuberant and to be, you know, willing to help other Black people fix their problems as well as themselves, then 30 years ago, those kids from 30 years ago would be the ones today in Flint, right? The ones who learned plumbing, the ones who learned engineering, mechanical, chemical, et cetera. They will be the ones in Flint today fixing that problem, regardless of whether the government drops a dollar in the area or not. And that's why the African-centered education is so important. All this European, you know, this Eurocentric education does is makes you go to them looking for a job after you got your certificate.
Word.
You know?
Word, that's deep and it's powerful, and I agree with you on that. And that's one thing. I know we keep going a little bit over on this topic, but this is important to me. This is a good conversation. The one thing that's not taught is tactics, man. Tactics and critical thinking. I think that's another thing missing from this whole thing, right? If you look at the whole Flint situation and tactics and critical thinking, like you hit on gentrification. Most people don't even know what gentrification is. Yeah, they do. They know it as, you know, white people moving in the neighborhood. No, you have to employ tactics in order to gentrify an area. You can't just say, all y'all move out and we're moving in, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You have to take certain steps and certain little things you have to do to get that native population, to get those residents out of there so you can move in. And you need to know about finances. You need to know about property values. You need to know about all these things in order to even see that plan that's being put in place.
Can I say one thing just to sum that up? There's one last thing.
Go ahead.
What Black folks need to understand is warring. See, white folks know warring. Warring employs all of that stuff you just mentioned just then, right? Warring is our issue. And when you understand warring, you'll understand that gentrification is warring. It's non-combat warring. If you look at what wars do, what do wars do? You go in, you decimate an area, you drive the people back, and you take the land, right? That's all, gentrification is. You decimate the area as the people retreat, you go in and you take that land back.
Scorched earth.
So it's about warring, right?
And there's nothing important in that, to harp on that, what you just said, just to know your role, right? Much like you have people who are more inclined to be great singers, they have the voice, they may not, you can improve it. You know, you can do tactics and you can go to classes and improve your singing voice, but you got to have that natural talent to it. I think education is sort of in that vein, right? You got to have the natural inclination to want to pass on this knowledge to be an educator, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's And then I'm saying you could take a basic person, and they could teach somebody something. But it's to be a talented teacher, to be a top echelon educator, to be a master teacher, you got to have this certain inclination, right? And as I got older, I kind of realized that, you know, I'm more so of a chaos bringer. I'm more of a warrior class type of person, right? I could teach you some stuff, but at the end of the day, I'm here to bring the war. Right. You know what I mean? Right. So you kind of got to know your role in this whole thing we got going on. And also, you know, one last thing that to harp on what you were saying there is to have a sense of worth. One of the things that always killed me, man, even when I was getting educated in this public school system, is that they always spoke on, like, you know, slavery and civil rights era, getting our ass beat and water holes sicked on us and fighting to be, you know, recognized as a human being and all that. So your whole perspective is that you're a slave. Some good white people came and freed you. And now, you know, you some other good white people made some laws so you can have some rights. Mm-hmm. Nowhere in that scenario are you taught that you came from, you know, great warrior classes, great educators, right? Some of the best philosophers in Greece went and got the education on the continent. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's how you were certified. That's how you got, you know, these Platos and these Socrates and things like that. They had to go to the continent and learn. You know what I'm saying? So, and when you realize that you come from a great, you know, heritage, you know what I mean? A lot of these white people, they trace their heritage back. They can go to their family seals.
Right.
As far back, they can go to the continent and see, oh, my great grandfather was the king or prince here, was a noble in this area and things like that. That gives you a sense of worth to think you can build up things, to know that you can, you know, change your environment and change the world essentially. And we are not getting that education. And even when I was like, I used to work on the railroad, right? I was out there a bunch of good old country boys, right?
Okay.
And so one of the things that I noticed from the jump was these dudes was like driving tractors at 9 years old, man. They was mm-hmm. at 10 years old, right? Mm-hmm. They was passing property on that they owned and land to the, you know, they inherited from their grandfather and things like that, right? A lot of stuff they learned was self-sufficiency, right? They can slaughter an animal and feed themselves and things like that. And we're not even getting that basic education, right? That's education too, know how to survive, survivability. That's why when people talk about this revolution and armed conflict and things like that, I'm like, how will you go to war with the people who control your food supply? That's idiotic. Right. Average people can't survive without a cell phone in their hand. Tell the average person, I tell people right now where I'm currently in Florida, right? Weather's nice, not 10 months out of the year is beautiful. Mm-hmm. All right, let's go on a hike in the woods, man. Let's go for a walk, man. Half the time you tell other black people that, like, I ain't walking through the woods, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you think gonna happen if you had to have a revolution, if you had to have an armed conflict? You too scared to walk on a nature trail, but you're talking to me about revolution. It doesn't add up to me. You know what I mean?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. You're absolutely right. I mean, everything you said is correct. It's like, who was it? I forgot who said it, but the only thing that comes second to war is education. And you'll see that these European folks, they know how to war, like I said before. And they know that in that warring, there's education. So like you said, you could go to the gun range. I've gone to the gun range in Virginia and stuff like that. And you go there and they have that 8-year-old kid, you know, they're holding the gun with them and firing a gun.
Exactly.
You know, so, you know, we laugh at some of the stuff and we call it goofy. Like you'll turn to certain channels on TV and see some white boys in cowboy hats with a lasso, you know, lassoing down a calf, but you don't realize that there's a need for that skill.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It looks goofy, but there's a need for it. I used to work around some white folks one time, and I remember, like, anytime there was like a 3 or 4 day weekend, these guys were talking about they're going camping. I'm talking about, I live in Brooklyn, New York with these folks, and they're going out to Maine or what's this place? Nevada. Not Nevada. This place where Bernie Sanders is. I forgot the name of it now. But anyway, they're going to these places and they're hunting. They're camping out. They're braving the elements. And that's what their ancestors did. They're connecting with their ancestorship by doing that as well. And we're not doing that. We're soft at this point.
that's the perfect word. I think you use soft, man. So yeah, you lose Wi-Fi service. Some of these people, you lose in their mind, but they
want. We're soft.
So let's move on to the next thing we got now with the recent headlines involving. We recently had Meghan Markle. I guess she did her interview with Oprah, talking about how she was wrong about a royal family or something like that, which I don't really want to get into because I don't care about. And then we had, Kamala Harris, you know, a lot of people is yes queening about her being, you know, the VP nomination and all those things. My question is, are Black people too quick to embrace any melanated person and much to the detriment of their own? One of the things that stood out to me is in Destruction of a Black Civilization, which I'm going to keep talking about because it's such a good book. But should that be a mandatory read in every household? They have a section in there where they talk about the biracial or the
mulatto.
The mulatto infiltrating and, you know, our people embracing them. And this was part of the destruction of the Black civilization. Right. What are your thoughts on that whole, you know, dichotomy and, you know, things that's going on as we see in America, you being in the U.S. now and seeing what's going on and how people are reacting to, you know, the Meghan Markle situation, Kamala Harris and things. Do you see like the history repeating itself, basically?
Absolutely. We are so starved that a pack of saltines tastes like the greatest food ever created, right? Like that's how hungry we are, you know. Some crackers will satisfy us. By that I mean we're so starved for, you know, to have our egos boosted that someone like Meghan Markle, who if you look at too quickly, you will say, well, that's a white woman over there. You know what I mean? Like you wouldn't even think Black. Right. And I was actually a fan of hers because she was in a show I used to like to watch. I forgot the name of it now, but she used to be in the show I used to like to watch. And I always looked at it and I noticed there was, you know, a little something different, you know, so I guess that's the little bit of Blackness she, you know, perhaps has. Right. But she's not a Black. She didn't live her life as a Black person. You know, and so we got to stop looking at these folks who didn't live a Black experience, a full-throated, wholehearted Black experience. They cannot be people that we look up to. You know, even Obama, right, didn't live a full Black experience.
Word.
So when Freddie Gray was getting his head bashed in the back of a van, a police van, and folks went out there to protest it, you know, Obama called them thugs.
Mm-hmm.
If you were connected, and again, this goes back, you know, it's going to turn out that this episode of the Harsh Reality Podcast is an episode about education, because this goes back to the education. You need to have elements of destruction of a Black civilization being mandatory, because one of the things, there's like a whole chapter, as D-Web said, that's dedicated to it, is about the mulatto problem. And these mulattoes are some of the most treacherous folks we have in Black society. And the reason why they're so treacherous is because Black people embrace them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're easier to embrace because they're not fully white. You feel me? So that makes people more comfortable to embrace them, but that right there is where the treachery lies. Mm-hmm. Everyone's sister girl, Kamala Harris or Scamala Harris, right? but I saw something the other day, and I see they refer to her as the first Asian American VP. Well, what happened to the Black? You see, it was just a game, just to boost your ego, right? And you help vote them in, but these people don't care about you, right? I think we're going to talk about this in a bit too, but, you know, look at, for example, now you have all these bills and this, that, and the other being passed to help out Asian folks. Why? Because you got a scam in Kamala Harris who really identifies herself as Asian, right? So now Asian folks will get benefits. You see what I'm saying? And Black folks will get nothing. We got to stop falling for the game.
Exactly. Have we got anything? We already know that when it comes to politics, right, America is usually about 50-50, right? That's why such a grab, such honor, such a race to get, you know, these different minority groups. We all know that the Black community, even a new president said that it's a monolithic voting society, right? Mm-hmm. So if it's society is about 50-50 between, you know, all the other races, all the other genders or whatever, you're going to have 50-50 Republican, Democrat. If you can get this one monolithic piece of society to, you know, in great numbers vote for you, that's your little push over the edge.
Yeah, that's a swing vote.
Yeah, that's your win right there, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's why, you know, you seen, and then they even gave you the playbook. This dude, even before announcing his VP choice, he's already said, I'm going to choose a woman of color, whatever the hell woman of color means. They telling you that they think that you're so lowly, low thinking, low vibrating being that they can just prop up any brownish person and get you to come vote for them. You know, absolutely. I take that as an insult, you know, mm-hmm. But a lot of people are yes queening and going about, oh, she's rocking Timberlands. And they are pushing the worst and lowest vibrating rhetoric you could ever imagine. Things that you would say to a 3-year-old, right? Mm-hmm. And they are pushing this onto you and the people are eating it up. And it's just so disheartening to me to see this. You know what I'm saying?
You see, knowledge is energy. And so if you don't have the right knowledge, you don't have the right energy. And because Black folks, for example, and even some of these other so-called brown folks or whatever, some, you know, Hispanics or whatever, we're not immersed in ourselves enough to have the energy, right, to know what's low energy and what's high energy. So like you just mentioned, which just made me cringe at the image of Kamala Harris wearing some Timberland boots and people's just fawning over her for it. It's low energy stuff. In fact, to be very honest with you, and I know a lot of people will feel insulted by it, but Black folks as a group are childlike. If we're being honest, right? You throw a shiny thing out there, Black folks will gravitate to that. They'll play with it. They'll giggle. You know, this is why, you know, as going back to early in the conversation, this is why a lot of the Black voices that were out there when I started this show, and when you discovered, started my show, the Bitter Medicine Podcast, a lot of those Black voices were clowns because they know that's what Black folks like, you know, and a lot of people get, you know, offended by that statement, but that's just what it is. We got to elevate. We have to grow up from being childlike now, right? And by the way, Western society is all about, like, infantilizing its people, by the way. And Black folks are falling directly into it, mm-hmm. right? Western society, that's what it's all about, that because the reality is a child cannot win a fight with adults.
Word.
You know? Facts.
Yeah. And you speak back to this. I'm very spiritual. You know, I'm more so spiritual than religious by any means. That's why the War with God episode resonated with me. I'm sitting here with crystals on my arm right now, trying to, you know, keep baggage away. But that speaks back to the spirituality that you need to be in tune to. You need to be in tune to frequencies in the world. These things are not, and it's funny because the same people they you know ridicule about, these are the people that believe in these energies and believe in these frequencies and things like that. That's why they push this. They're able to push these properties. They're able to lead you where they want you to lead you because they know more about your spirituality than you do.
Absolutely.
And people need to realize that, right? So you need to vibrate high, man. If you don't know what I mean, I got some good book suggestions and things like that can help you with that. But you need to get in tune with your frequencies. You need to learn about chakras. You know, as crazy as it sounds, you need to learn these things. And then one thing, and it seems like it's a broken record, man. Malcolm X talked about this in the freaking 60s, man. Stop making celebrities, athletes, and entertainers your role models, your so-called leaders. It doesn't work. They are beholden to the system. Their whole means of income is beholden to this system. So when you're listening to LeBron James, you know what I'm saying? When you're listening to, you know, Kevin Hart, when you're listening to these people and Cardi B and taking political advice from these people, you're lost. You're in the matrix. You're knee deep in the matrix, man. These people are not here to lead you to prominence. They're not here to uplift you or empower you. They're here to get their bag, right? They are agents. You know what I mean? They're agents of the state. So you need to realize this. And that's part of what, you know, what we're saying. And that's how these people are able to push through a Kamala and things like that. And people will vehemently attack you if you criticize. This woman made a career of locking black folks up. Mm-hmm. And y'all, yes, queening for her. It's nonsensical. You know what I mean?
Yeah, she's a compromised individual, as are most athletes, you know, actors and other entertainers. And, you know, like I said on one episode of my show before, it's okay for these folks to have an opinion. That's fine. You could have, you know, everyone is entitled to an opinion. But your opinion shouldn't, these folks' opinion in particular, shouldn't become the top voice for our community. You see? So exactly. You have a guy like Ice Cube who had that plan or whatever it was called, right? It's cool that you have an opinion on that stuff, but you're not the guy to do it. There's more talented, more people, you know, there's people who are more immersed.
More qualified, exactly.
More qualified to have that discussion, not you.
Exactly. Your job should be supporting these voices that we have.
Support the voices, right.
Exactly. Right. So let's move on to the next one. I don't want to take up too much of your time. Try, you know, to keep these episodes to like an hour, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I feel you.
So we got the Asian Lives Matter movement, the ALM movement. And we I know you recently had a good rant about this.
Yeah.
But I want to revisit. Is this a tactic, you know, for further division while demonizing the black and the African communities? They're harping on the statistics saying that the amount that black people attack Asians is high. And the whole thing stems from actually a white guy killing a bunch of
yeah.
So I don't even know how the hell we get involved in this, but that's one thing is that they bringing up is that the black community as a whole, you're more likely as an Asian person to be attacked by a black person than a black person to be attacked by an Asian person. And then this all stems from so they got this new movement, and like you said, you spoke on earlier, they're passing all these bills and laws too to benefit the Asian community, right? A lot of celebrities, athletes. I seen Damian Lillard with his you know, Stop the Asian Hate shirt on the other day and things like that, capping for the mainstream narrative. So what's your thoughts on this Asian ALM movement, Asian Lives Matter movement, Stop Asian Hate movement, or whatever you want to call it?
Activate, rant. Listen, man, you know, to begin with, what's the Asian guy's name? I forgot this Asian dude's name, but he's like in hip hop. He's been around for like, you know, for a good number of years in hip hop, like 30 years in hip hop. Forgot his name now. Bald-headed Asian guy. But he said, he's Asian himself. And he said, look, y'all stop the bullshit. y'all, you know, our Asian people have been anti-black from the beginning, and we continue it, right? We practice it all the time. So stop the bullshit with the anti-Asian hate shit, right? And I have to agree with that Asian fella, because listen, I live in New York, right? There's Asians with restaurants all over black neighborhoods. I'm talking, you could see two Chinese restaurants next door to each other, literally, right? And they're all making their money. It doesn't make sense that black folks just all of a sudden start attacking Asians all of a sudden, right? But you guys aren't afraid by the violence. There's no fear. You come to work every day and make your money off black folks. Make it make sense. And if you have that much of a problem with black folks, then maybe you should get up out of black neighborhoods, but you won't do it because that's your economic lifeline.
Exactly.
So stop the bullshit with the black folks are attacking you. And yeah, I've seen these little videos and stuff like that, which makes me skeptical of their truth, right? I feel sometimes some of this stuff is staged, you know. But you know, and why is it, you know, if it's staged, for example, why is it being done? Well, they're trying to get a soft power here in the States. Remember, Asians have been fighting, especially in recent years, to be a part of white supremacy. Now they're calling it out now. That's because white folks didn't let them in. And so now they're trying to use this black, I guess what they consider a black tactic, right, of integration, right? So they're trying to push this narrative that they're being attacked, oh, come and help us with being treated like black folks and this stuff. And so the white folks come and scoop you up and elevate you, right? But it's about power. It's about soft power. When Peter Liang killed Akai Gurley here in New York, these Asian mofos went out there and protested with placards and all kind of stuff, talking about, you know, Peter Liang is being scapegoated. Why is he being hemmed up? And all these white guys who have committed all these acts before haven't been hemmed up. So what are you saying? You're saying, how come he doesn't get away with it like they do?
Exactly.
You know, so it's a power move. And I'm skeptical of it with Kamala Harris being the quote-unquote first Asian VP and her history, as you mentioned, with her, you know, arresting black men. I'm skeptical of what it might lead to. It might lead to some type of crime bill where you further criminalize black men now. So, you know, that's my early thoughts on it. But they need to stop that bullshit.
Yeah, it's bullshit. If you look at some of the demographics, they say women lie, men lie, numbers don't, right? If you look at the demographics, right, yeah, are the fasting, one of the fastest rising, some of the most educated people, some of the, you know, fastest gaining in terms of wealth and generational wealth and acquiring this stuff, it is the Asian community, right? They're kicking ass, right? They had to even make a law where they had to make some of these universities had to employ policy so that they wouldn't have all Asian students coming in for the next class. You know what I mean? That's how much they're killing it, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, how can a group that is thriving in the area be the focus of the hate, right?
Right.
You could not survive in America. You know, black people don't control anybody's fate in this country, as we all know. We can't decide who rises and who falls by any means, a stretch of the imagination, right? So how is it that these people are so subject to hate, subject to attack, subject to, you know, being discriminated against, but you're still killing every demographic of everything, right? It doesn't make any sense. And even if you look at crimes, right, crimes are always crimes of opportunity. If you look at who are at the bottom of the wealth gap, right, like who's at the bottom of every financial statistic is going to be the black community. So therefore, if you have, you know, a robbery, if you have a crime of opportunity where you can make some fast cash, it's most likely going to be the poorest people committing those crimes. Is it not? The people who have nothing to lose. The people who, you know, who think that they can maybe gain something from that. So when you have these examples, different examples of, oh, this Asian business owner was, you know, robbed, leaving his business and things like that. Of course, most of the time it's going to be a black guy. Because, like you said, it's a multifaceted problem. It's not a single, you know, it's not a very simple solution to this problem. This is a multifaceted, nuanced thing. And, so if you're liable to get, you know, robbed or jacked, even if you look at the Hispanic community, right, where a lot of them are construction workers, they work construction, they work in cash businesses, they're more likely to be robbed by, you know, a black person, right? It's just, it's a crime of opportunity. It happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then they're elevating these single incidents and these multifaceted incidents, and they're just trying to say that it's a, you know, a hate thing, when reality, come on now, the black community loves everybody. Right. Everybody can open a business in the black. You can have it's Chinese restaurants in every black community in America. How many soul food restaurants are there in Chinatown?
Right.
So, you know, you're taking a problem that's multifaceted between the wealth gap, between, you know, crimes of opportunity, between, you know, things of this nature. And then you're trying to, you know, trying to make it so that it's just one sided Asian hate type of deal. And that's disingenuous. And we all know that, right?
So I also want to say this, too. I'll put this out there for your listeners. A part of why I think they're doing it is a power move, right? It's to move up and to hold a place in U.S. society. But it's also a backlash to Trump. Mm. And what I mean by that is, remember, Trump aptly called this pandemic the China virus.
Mm-hmm.
Listen. When shit comes out of Africa, y'all don't have no problem calling it the West Nile virus or Ebola or some shit, right?
Right.
Like, there's a history of naming viruses from the believed location of origin, right? And so when Trump went out there and called it China virus, and some people added Kung Flu, which is some real bullshit, but funny as hell, right? When Trump and them was doing that, remember, you had some black folks out here on social media talking about you gotta patronize these Chinese businesses because they're feeling it. No, I don't, right? They created their own fortune, and so this pandemic did come out of Wuhan, China. That's just what it is.
Word.
You understand? And so you have some blame to take for that shit. I don't care how you feel about it, right? But I think a part of it is a pushback towards the general misfeelings towards Asians from the China virus stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's what they're all, I think they're trying to kind of erase that from memory to a certain extent. And how do you erase something from memory, right? History has shown us you show suffering. Oh, we suffered so bad.
Mm-hmm.
And people forget that other bullshit from the past. You know what I mean? So, you know, this is what's really, I think this is a big part of what's going on here. They're trying to change the narrative.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. Even the rhetoric itself, even the whole Asian Lives Matter or Asian hate thing. It's like, have you ever been through the, first of all, Asia is a huge continent, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's people in Asia that are blacker than me and you. Mm-hmm. so that in itself is kind of, you know, kind of an oxymoron to me. It's like, stop Asian. Hey, who's Asian? You know, you're breaking down hundreds of ethnic groups, of cultural groups, and you're we know who you're talking about, right? You want to say stop Japanese and Chinese hate. You know
exactly.
What I mean?
Exactly. Exactly. Yep.
And so that in itself is makes it disingenuous to me because, like I say, you're not talking about Mongolians. You're not talking about, you right. know, people in Thailand or anything like that. You're talking to us exclusive, two groups mostly.
Yeah.
And so you need to say that, right? But they're not doing that. They're making it a multifaceted problem to get everybody involved. Because who doesn't like Asian? Who doesn't agree with Asian? Who doesn't even have maybe a relative right now living in the Asian continent, which is freaking huge? You know, Russians are Asian. Right. So are we talking about Russians? So, you know, that in itself kind of makes the movement, you know, I have to look at it with a side eye, like you say, and particularly with who's in office right now. But
listen, in sixth grade, I drop kicked a guy and I shouted out Bruce Lee while I did it. So, I mean, who, you know, shout out to Bruce Lee and that, you know what I mean?
Shout out to Bruce Lee, man. Bruce Lee kind of had a little fro too. He might have been part
bubble. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Let's move on to the next thing. We got the last topic we got about Pan-Africanism went right up your alley. Is Pan-Africanism as a whole still an achievable goal, particularly with the growing ADOS FBA movements? We kind of hit this when we did the episode where we all came together, KWAZ family, and kind of hit on this. But I kind of want to dive back into it with you alone and see what you think, particularly since some months have passed and we're seeing a lot more hostility, particularly if you look at the reparations movement, right? A lot of people, same people who are, you know, clamoring for reparations are some of the same people that's saying that, you know, Pan-Africanism itself is a trap, right? Or that Africans look down upon the African-American, as they call them, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about Pan-Africanism? Do you think it's still an achievable goal? Or do you see with the, you know, growing movements with the ADOS, is it kind of like, you know, dying a slow death. You know what I mean? What do you think?
So, yeah. So the ADOS FBA group would say Pan-Africanism is dead, right? The truth of the matter is, though, Pan-Africanism will never die. And the reason is because Pan-Africanism is what really led to the Black Conscious Movement. It was folks suffering in Africa, folks suffering in the Caribbean, folks suffering in the UK, in the US, right? Realizing that the suffering that they're going through is similar, right? And being encouraged by the movements in other places and bringing those types of movements and those ideologies to the struggle in their locality. And so Pan-Africanism is interwoven in anything that's called Black consciousness, you see? And so you can never kill it. You can delay it, though. And what's happening now is we're seeing it being delayed. And not just now, it's been happening throughout, you know, the last 120 something years now, right? It's just being pushed back and delayed further and further and further. And the biggest culprit is that we're not educating our children and making it a cultural education as well to be Pan-Africanists, to identify that I'm struggling in Haiti or the Bahamas or Jamaica or Louisiana or what have you. And there's folks in Nigeria and Ghana who are and the Congo who have the same or very similar struggles. And to identify, hey, what are their conscious elite, so to speak, like their talented few, what are they doing to fix the problem? Like, for example, what did the Congo do to fix their water problem when they had a water problem? Maybe that's something our Black folks in Flint, Michigan can adopt, right? And right. So Pan-Africanism is alive and well, but it's stunted. The growth of it is stunted. And the recent ADOS and FBA type stuff has really hit it a blow that is going to take a long time to recover from, you know? It's going to take a long time to recover from. And the truth of the matter is, we as a people, we don't have all the time in the world, right? We have to be expedient. We have to get to solving this problem, because the further we fall back behind these Euro savages, the harder it's going to be for us ever, ever to stand on this earth in power.
Word. And I'm gonna throw this out there, you know, because you know I'm native born here. You know, one side of my relatives is from like Alabama or something, and one side is from Mississippi. Right? Can't get more Negro than me. But one thing I think that a lot of people have a problem with, particularly ADOS and FBA, because I'm more of a neutral party. You know what I'm saying? I see benefits in both sides, but at the same time, you cannot isolate yourself. Right? Is the worst. The worst move you can make as somebody who's being, you know, oppressed, or somebody who's being, who's at the bottom of the totem pole, is to try to isolate yourself, right? Because it's not going to work. You have no allies, right?
Right.
I think a lot of people see it as American culture is not respected, right? Black American culture is not respected. They see by the a lot of the Pan-Africanists, a lot of people on the continent, right? Everything revolves back to the continent. We need to get back to African spirituality. We need to get back to, you know, our African roots. We need to, you know, go to the continent, things like that. I don't think they see their culture as being respected largely by, you know, Africans or Pan-Africanists. You know what I mean? They see it as, you know, a culture, like you said, a culture of entertainment, a culture of goofy hip hop, twerking, things like that, right? So they are being attacked. And once you take a people and you tell them that, you know, everything that you pretty much have seen your whole life is some trash, right? You need to get back to the continent. You're lost. When you're putting out this negative energy, right, they're going to reject it. So I think part of the ADOS and growing FBA movement is fueled by maybe some people on the Pan-African side or some people on the African side looking down upon American culture.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I think that needs to be addressed. Even now, you know, I had a discussion with a brother on social media in terms of, you know, it could have been some brownish people in America prior beforehand. I was not taking a strong stance on this, right? I'm just like, this is some evidence that it could be possible, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like vehemently attacked by like bad Africans, and which I don't care, you know. I like to troll a little bit, right? Right. So it was entertaining to me. But the thing is like, you know, when you look down upon a whole culture, when you look down upon a whole society, man, and that's all they got, it's a saying that you always will attract, you know, more flies with honey than you can vinegar, right?
Absolutely.
But when you come with straight negativity, of course, you're going to create an opposite movement. And I think part of the ADOS movement is derived from being looked down upon about African nations. They say even when Africans immigrate here from the continent to America, one of the things they tell them is not to interact with the African Americans, right? I don't know how true that is, but I've heard that from multiple people. You know what I mean?
There's some truth to it, but not in the way that it's usually put out there. It's usually put out there that, a few things. It's usually put out there that the Africans, be it from the continent, the Caribbean, wherever, that in their home countries, they're somehow vetted to come here and be anti-Black American. I can tell you there's no such meeting before jumping on that plane to come here. What it is, and I've explained this on my show before too, but what it is this. The African from the continent or the African from the Caribbean, especially those two areas, they've known self-determination to a certain point for a while now, right? You know, the first African country started to get liberated in the 50s and stuff like that, and the Caribbean in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it's no coincidence that that coincides with the civil rights movement here in America. Right. Again, that goes to show you how we have shared struggle and we learn from each other across the diaspora as to what other folks are doing for their freedom, for, you know. And anyway, and so because these areas have had some self-determination time, mm-hmm. they see things differently. And that's just natural. That's not to say that they're better than anyone. It's just what it is. So, for example, I can tell you with confidence, I grew up, my prime minister was Black. I grew up, my doctor was Black. I grew up, my priest was Black. Most of my teachers were Black. Every facet of life that I could think of, most of the people were Black. And in that, you know, you see yourself. There's some self-determination that comes from that. And so when those folks come to this country, which is a white nation, right, that has a Black population, those folks are going to move just a little bit differently, because mm-hmm. the folks here, our Black brothers and sisters here, let's be honest, when I look at the job situation, we're working for white folks here. You know, your churches are segregated, and that's probably the only reason why it's not all white, you know, priests in your church and stuff. So much aspects of the life here, you have to go literally to white folks for that transaction. It does something different. And I think people see it. And unfortunately, you have scoundrels wherever you point on a map. There's a scoundrel there, right? You have scoundrels who come here and they try to kind of like clown folks on it, right? So like, what I'm trying to say is, like, folks will come and say, well, you know, we don't have the same reverence or whatever to white folks because where we come from, we ran our shit, right? We ran our stuff, but here you guys aren't usually running your stuff. Mm-hmm. Again, look at Flint, right? You're not usually running your stuff. And so just our general disposition is different. It's not to say better, it's just different. And so the pushback then from Black Americans was that, well, look, y'all come to our country. You see what I'm saying? So it starts mm-hmm. to become this one-upsman type thing going back and forth. And that's the that's really the problem. It's this constant need for folks to feel like they're better than someone else. That's just a human condition.
Crab in a barrel mentality. Yeah. Because nobody's benefited that.
No.
And then if you look at, I think one of the major issues is it's been a lack. It's never been really. If you go through history, or at least recent history, you have a lack of an African superpower, right?
Right.
And you look at all these countries at one time or another, you know, were superpowers, particularly in recent country. Now you have to go way back in the day to see an African superpower, right? Mm-hmm. So people don't really have that that connection, that sense of pride. They even go to the point where they're looking at a fake country in Wakanda as a sense of, you know, pride in being black and being African, you know what I mean? But if you had that example of an African superpower, like you said, your prime minister was black. We need where's the black continent's kicking ass, right? Why are they not bowing down to them? You know, if you look at the American president, they go to Saudi Arabia and bow to the king of Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
That's a sense of pride for the Arab community, right? You don't have that same thing. Most leaders that go to Africa, they go there and to exploit the continent, right? And if we had that sense of pride in that African nation as a superpower, I think that would go a long ways into kind of, you know, counteracting a lot of these negative movements. If you look at the ADOS movement as a general, I thought it was started for reparations, right? But more and more so, you see the anti-African rhetoric, right? Mm-hmm. And then the thing is, even if it is about reparations, anything you do in America, you gotta realize when we go back to tactics, we go back to strategy, we're gonna go back to Sun Tzu's art of war, right? Mm-hmm. If you're not beneficial, you're not gonna get anything. And my thing is, I always tell the people, I say, you pay your taxes on time, you go to work. Okay, y'all playing the Olympics under the American flag, things of that nature, right? So why in the hell would you think you're getting reparations in the first place, right? What would be the benefit as a whole for, you know, America to pay you anything? You know what I'm saying? And there's no answer to that. I never get an answer to that. You know what I mean? Like, what would be what would be America's incentive to bring back rep at the goodness of their hearts? You know?
Right. It's just foolish. The thing is this too, and I'm glad you brought this up too. Reparations is largely a fool's errand. Mm-hmm. There's reparations groups in the Caribbean, in the continent, in the UK. It's largely a fool's errand, but you know what? If some folks want to spend their time on it, go for it, man. Knock yourself out. if you're really about your reparations, then talk about your reparations. Don't become, you know, the Alex Joneses of the world, where all of a sudden you talking about cake soap Twitter, and you're trying to, you know, clown folks for how they look and talking about they ain't us. They don't look like us. And that's not reparations.
No.
Right? That's xenophobia. That's internalized self-hate. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. And I'll be honest with you, when the ADOS and FBA stuff first started happening, I saw it was going to be a problem, but a lot of people didn't take it seriously. And when I listened to the early rhetoric, one of the things I noticed was a lot of it had to do with flag envy, in my opinion. Like in New York here, we have this, you know, pre-pandemic, we have this thing called the West Indian Labor Day Parade, right? That's where all the Caribbean groups come out and they have the different camps and, you know, music and dance and all this kind of stuff, which I think, frankly, black folks do too much dancing and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, that's a day, right? That happens here in New York. And everyone comes out with their flags and they represent, for their tribe, you know, and that's fine. But I always felt like, I think, especially here, like in New York, I felt like our brothers and sisters in America here looked at that event and felt othered. They weren't in that group. They weren't in those festivities, right?
Right.
And I think a lot of it really stemmed from that, kind of like a flag envy. And, you know, the rhetoric is to, in fact, I just saw someone today, I think Ghetto Intellectual on Twitter said it, you know, stop waving that rag, which is the American flag. And that's something, you know, our American ancestors were saying that type of stuff years ago, you know, decades ago. And so I think what has happened is ADOS and FBA has been a pushback, as you mentioned, to a perceived negativity. Right. Again, there's a-holes and idiots in every group. So one a-hole, you know, like they kept mentioning like Cynthia Erivo, who played Harriet. She's a Brit, if I'm not mistaken. Or actually, she might be Nigerian originally. Mm-hmm. And one of her friends named Lovey said something about Akatas. And that, like, that was a big catchphrase on social media for a while. This is Akata talk. Listen, you're going to have some idiots who are going to do that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, are we solving our problems or are we not? Mm. Let's focus on solving the problems. Forget the idiots. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And that's a big thing, too. You can just take isolated incidents like we were talking about earlier conversation. You could take isolated idiots, take isolated incidents. You can magnify these, make these go viral, and that'll become the norm. Right. That'll become what everybody sees. Right.
Right. So, right.
That's where critical thinking comes into play. And also, I would say, even talking to people. I think you have a lot of people who just see these incidents, see these isolated, see these viral little videos of Tariq Nasheed talking and things like that, and they run off that and have yet to have a conversation with a Pan-Africanist or, you know what I mean, a Pan-Africanist and ADOS talk about something relevant, right? If a lot of times, if you get people in the room and they start to talk, you will see you have way more in common than you have apart. And these conversations are not had. These conversations are not, you know, privy to these people, right? It's not prioritized to have these conversations and to talk and to see what's going on. Everything is a viral moment. Everything is a 10-second video where you can make whatever judgment you want off it, depending on who you follow, right? Depending on what cult leader you decide to be under. And I think that's part of the bigger issue we have, you know what I'm saying? We need to have these conversations. Even me talking to you right now, you know, about it, that opens up something, right? We can get to the bottom of a problem. We can see, we can break it down logically because we're logical thinking men, right? And we can decipher these problems, but those conversations are not being had. It's all about division. Because you make, like you said, when you made that video about 5150 and talking about the beef thing, they love that, ate that up, right? Beef is great. But God forbid you have a conversation about uniting. God forbid you have a compromise about what problems we need to tackle. That's not hot. That's not hot in the streets, right?
No. You know, like Dr. John Henry Clark said, man, be proud of where you're from, you know. There's no problem with that. But always remember you're an African. And I think that needs to be front and center in an African-centered education as well. Be proud of where you're from. Look, you have family from Mississippi, Alabama. Be proud of that, right? There's great traditions amongst Africans who were in Alabama and Mississippi. You know what I'm saying? Great traditions with Africans who are in Florida. Same thing with those in the Bahamas or those in Haiti or Trinidad or, you know what I'm saying, Jamaica, Nigeria. Mm-hmm. So be proud of where you're from. If you're a runner and you win a gold medal and you ran for Nigeria, sure, you put it out there that you won a gold medal for, you know, Nigeria or whatever. That's fine. But at the end of the day, underneath all that stuff, just remember you're an African. If we could get to that, to just remember, because the reality is when we identify and understand that we are African, whether we were here in America before Columbus or not, before the slave trade happened, you came from Africa, right? And once you acknowledge that and you embrace that, you'll realize that we actually have more things in common than we have different, right? And the differences that we have usually come from the interactions we've had in our localities with these Eurasian folks. That's really where the differences come from, okay? And so this infighting stuff is just non-productive, and it's just expanding the time and the gap between us and them wider and wider and wider. I don't know if you saw this, but they said that African-Americans or Black folks in America are 250 years behind white folks in wealth. Now, doesn't that 250 years seem interesting? Because that's about the same amount of time Black folks were chattel slaves in America. Mm-hmm. Right? So that chattel slavery, for example, for those of us out in this Western hemisphere, that has us behind 250 years. We ain't got time to be adding more time to 250, right?
Word.
We ain't got time.
Nah, we in the bottom of the knife.
Yeah.
Two outs.
Yeah, two outs. We ain't got time.
We ain't got time. And I think that's a good point to wrap it up, man. So if you got anything you want to plug in terms of your business information, events, social medias, podcasts, whatever you got, man, it's your time to shine. Put it out there.
All right. First of all, the Bitter Medicine Podcast, new episodes live streamed every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Come through our live. You know, it's a small channel, but our chat room is usually pretty nice. There's a lot of nice interaction between me and the chat while I'm reading some paper, some research paper on some issue or some aspect of the Black experience or the African experience. So make sure to come through. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Just do a search, the Bitter Medicine Podcast. You'll find us. We have a Discord server. D-Web is on there already. You guys can join. You could come through. We're working on an African-centered curriculum, a curriculum that reconnects our youth with their community, their culture, and their tradition, and gives them the knowledge that they need to be able to solve the problems in their community, right? So you guys could come through and help with that. And last thing I'll say, this show, D-Web was kind enough to join KWAZ Radio. I'm on KWAZ Radio as well. We're looking for more voices to be on there. If you guys think you have something to say, you think you have something that's worthwhile to talk about, join us on KWAZ Radio. Become a podcaster like us, and let's help each other monetize these shows. You guys make sure donate to the Patreon for the Harsh Reality Podcast. You know, let's see these little shows, these little channels. Let's make them great, man. Let's make them the voice of the people.
Word, that's dope. And I got something in the works too. I'm gonna share it with you. We're gonna talk, but but I appreciate you coming on, man. Like I said, you were a great inspiration for me to even think that I had the voice to even come on here and talk and stuff like that, man. And I will forever appreciate you, brother. And I'm definitely a believer in giving people their flowers while they're still here. And so, you know what I mean, I gotta thank you from the bottom of my heart for imparting a lot of knowledge upon me and giving me that confidence, man. So shout out to you, Goku, man. I appreciate you and your platform, brother.
Yeah, I appreciate you too. I remember you as an early supporter when I first started the Facebook page and stuff. You were one of the first people who would contact me and ask me a question about the Carlos Cooks reader or what have you. And so you'll always be remembered. And when I approached you about joining the network, you didn't hesitate. And that's the kind of thing I like to see from African people. Let's not hesitate to unite,
Exactly. And on that note, I think that's a great note to end this on. And I got to say, on behalf here at the Harsh Reality Podcast, peace.
Peace.